Live from the great American Northwest, it's Pro Libertate Radio, a full-throttle, no-holds-barred examination of the threats to life, liberty, and property. Now, here's our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Gregg.
I have mentioned on more than a few occasions that I am an incurable, hopeless sci-fi geek, and my taste in science fiction is debatable. Among the programs I enjoyed, and I mentioned this before too, was a really kitschy mid-1970s British-produced television series called Space 1999. As a matter of fact, I went so far as a few years ago to write a feature-length screenplay for a movie based on that property, and I actually had interested a producer in it. Unfortunately, he was involved in a different project, and by the time that project was finished, it was a very worthwhile one. My friend was incurably sick, and he wasn't able to find the time or the energy to look at the script after having his reader go through it, and she gave it a very positive review. I submitted it to a couple of other people but never heard back. I don't know why I liked that show so much, apart from the fact that this was the pre-Cambrian era, or at least pre-cable television era, in which we had just three network affiliates here in the Treasure Valley. At the time, I lived in Oregon rather than Idaho, but it was part of the contiguous Treasure Valley. And Star Trek had been canceled, and the novelty had worn off after I'd seen the reruns even then. They'd only been available for a few years, but I'd seen the reruns of each program at least a dozen times, and here was something new, something relatively fresh on the menu. There was an episode, it was the second episode broadcast in the local area here, but it wasn't the second episode in production, of that program called Black Sun. And of course, that refers to the astronomical phenomenon. Theoretical, there are people whose opinions I respect who don't believe that such objects exist. They believe that the relativistic dicta that supports the existence of black holes is mistaken. In any case, that refers to a black hole. It was called Black Sun. That's more evocative, more poetic. This is largely a fantasy program, but I think that we can give it the benefit of poetic license in this instance, calling it Black Sun. The television show's premise was the following. There was a facility called Moonbase Alpha that was created for the purpose of keeping a watch on nuclear waste that was being disposed on the far side of the moon, mistakenly referred to as the dark side of the moon in this program. It also served as a scientific research outpost and was involved in the production and the dispatch of space probes into the further reaches of the solar system. September 13, 1999 dawned on a new day, and not a particularly good one for the human race, because there was an accident on the far side of the moon that somehow ripped the moon out of orbit and sent a large portion of Luna careening off into the mysterious depths of deep space. And so the inhabitants of Moonbase Alpha, unwittingly and completely unintentionally, are humanity's emissaries to the cosmos now on what amounts to the unintentional first starship that was propelled into deep space by the explosion of the accumulated nuclear waste on the far side. Now, there are too many scientific implausibilities here for me to limb. I will just simply say, go with the premise for the purpose of the following anecdote. In the second episode production, Black Sun, they encounter somewhere, I'm guessing, near the solar system, a black hole, and they're being drawn inexorably into its mysterious and very ominous depths. Nothing is going to change their trajectory, and they have very little hope that the force field they managed to rig to protect Moonbase Alpha is going to protect them. At one point, the two main characters, Commander John Koenig and Victor Bergman, who was the chief science officer, are sitting in the otherwise abandoned control center in a moment of melancholy reflection. They're toasting each other with Beaujolais and wondering what's going to happen to them because they've got no prospect for survival by any physical laws they can imagine. John turns to Victor, the scientist, and says, what do you think is going to happen to us once we cross the event horizon and go into the black hole? And Victor sits there pensively, and then a winsome smile creases his craggy and late middle-aged features, and he says, I don't know, all I hope is that it will be interesting. You know, that's sort of where we are right now, as we stand at the event horizon of this huge political and economic singularity that is opening up in front of us. I don't know what's going to happen. On the basis of what I understand of the laws of economics, there's no way we're going to avoid being consumed by this monstrosity. There are precedents in human history, many, many precedents in human history, for societies that have spent themselves into oblivion through the adulteration of currency, through the stupid deferral of responsibility in the interest of immediately enjoying without penalty or proper investment of time and effort the fruits of the labor of others. That's happened to many societies in the past. It's happening to us right now. Usually what happens is that a society that finds itself on the brink, they've passed the Schwarzschild radius, they're beyond the event horizon, they're now within the grasp, the apparently unbreakable grasp of this singularity, stronger than Charybdis, more destructive than any force known to man, they find that they come out at the terminus of the singularity in a different political universe. That's what happened to France when it was convulsed by its debt meltdown in the 18th century that led to the Jacobin Revolution. The Jacobin Revolution was something that was planned and exploited many of the trends we're talking about. That happened to Germany, most infamously. It also happened to the Soviet Union in what was formerly Russia in the late 19-teens and early 1920s. I don't know what's going to happen. We have a continent-spanning commercial nominal republic that is consumed and devoured by this economic singularity. I don't know what alternate universe we're going to end up living in after we make the passage through the economic black hole. I don't know what our society is going to look like as a result of the changes that are about to convulse our society, for which we're, for the most part, neither physically nor intellectually prepared. All I can say is that I hope it will be interesting, and I'm confident it will be. As a matter of fact, I think it's going to be interesting in ways I can't imagine, or perhaps I can dimly imagine when I find myself sitting bolt upright at night in fever dreams of apocalyptic developments are driving sleep away from me. I can dimly imagine, I think, some of the things that are likely to happen. I can say that if you have the means to be independent in terms of the necessities of life, by all means, exercise those means. You should be storing food. You should have stored food already. Still time to do it. By all means, do it right away. We have done that. We have been living on what we have stored. You store what you eat and eat what you store, as the cliche informs us. If you have the means to trade your Federal Reserve notes for actual specie money, that's a very good thing to do. Bear in mind, if things become really, really bad, it's better to have lead than silver. Lead is the fourth of the noble metals in my estimation, and ultimately the most important. The noble metals, of course, are gold, silver, and platinum, and lead. They all have their uses. With gold, you can often buy lead, but if you have enough lead, you don't have to worry about paying for it. That's an unfortunate reality. I would not use my lead to acquire somebody else's gold by force, but I would use my lead to protect what I have. If that's what I have to do in order to keep my family from harm, keep them breathing and eating and warm, you betcha. I'm not a pacifist. I do believe in the non-aggression ethic, and I pray every single day that God will grant that when my eyes finally close for the final time in this existence, they will do so by way of punctuating a life that has not seen me shed innocent human blood, or for that matter, guilty human blood. But if necessary, I would use lethal means to protect my family from criminal aggression from any quarter. And that's why I consider lead to be the most important of the four noble metals. If you have the means to acquire land and develop it so as to be self-sustaining, that is the most valuable thing you can possess right now. I'm not talking about commercial real estate. I'm talking about something that can be husbanded in a way that will yield the necessities of life. Jim Rogers, the legendary investor, talks about the idea that very soon we'll all be living in such a changed environment that farmers are going to have the prestige that doctors and lawyers and practitioners of the dark arts of financial arbitrage have recently enjoyed. Suddenly that's going to become a prestige profession because of the importance that people are going to place on developing the means to sustain us from the land. Jim Rogers believes that people should seriously consider relocating to Asia. I couldn't do that. I'm staying here for the duration. By here, I mean Idaho, primarily. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. 866-986-6397 is our call-in number. We'll be back in just a minute. Story is about a year and a half old, almost 2 years old actually, but it is still timely. One of God's little ironic tricks, I think, is found in the fact that the fellow who was the chief administrator for the TARP program was a Goldman Sachs bagman by the name of Neil Kashkari. N-E-E-L-K-A-S-H-K-A-R-I. I think he's Armenian. I don't know for sure. I think that's an Armenian name. Neil Kashkari, a rather striking man with a tonsured head. He looks a little like the actor who played Captain Robow from Star Trek from 2009, or the villain, I can't remember the name of the villain from Iron Man 2008. And of course, once again, I'm establishing my geek credentials here. Neil Kashkari is a guy in his 30s who was the chief administrator of the $700 billion TARP payout, which is just a small, almost insignificant portion of that huge exercise in fraud and corruption. He's the guy who was administering the bailout of the banks. What did he do immediately after he rescued the banks? He got the hell out of Washington as far away as he possibly could. He bought a tract of land in the mountains of Northern California, and he built a cabin. This guy headed for high ground. He was the guy administering the bailout of the banks. He bugged out and went off the grid. There are some of us who would consider that to be a clue as to what we can expect. This is from the Washington Post, from December 6th, 2009. He wears no coat, though it's freezing, shines no light, though it's near midnight, carries no shotgun, though he's tramping on the pine needle tracks of black bears. He wants to be lost in these woods. "Come on, you bums," Neil Kashkari calls to his dogs, two giant Newfoundlands. "Boys, let's go." He is walking through the smoke of a controlled burn in the Sierra Nevadas. He is talking about the people and the life he left behind in Washington. And it wasn't about politics. They were non-political. These people were killing themselves, in Don's case, literally. The moon hits his stubble, which is 6 days old. Mine, by the way, is about 4 days old. What's really weird is that it's white now. When I moved here 4 years ago, 5 years ago almost, my stubble was black. It's now white. That sort of freaks me out. But I digress. And the sweater he hasn't changed in 3 or 4 days. That's a sentence fragment, by the way. It's not my fault. His BlackBerry, he can't kick it, rang once today. A year ago in D.C., it buzzed every few seconds. All night, he'd roll over to its bluish glow. His Treasury Department assistant slept with hers, powered up, on her pillow. "It's like a dream," Kashkari says, his work boots crunching pine cones. Sometimes I think, was it real? It all began as it ended abruptly. Kashkari was a 35-year-old business school graduate from a suburb of Akron, Ohio, who had gone to Washington in 2006 to learn how government worked. Then came the recession, and through a freakish set of circumstances, mixing pluck, cataclysm, and luck, he was appointed by Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson as the federal bailout chief. Suddenly he was in charge of $700 billion. Congress savaged him. Wall Street Journal editorials doubted him. His hometown buddies urged him to use the money to buy the Cleveland Browns and fire the coaches. His wife spoke to him so rarely, she described them as dead to each other. Boy, that's bad. He lost sleep, gained weight, and saw a close advisor, Don Hammond, suffer a heart attack at his Treasury desk. On May 1st, after serving 7 months under Presidents Bush and Obama, he resigned. Within a week, Cash Carey and his wife put their belongings into indefinite storage. They moved to a cabin near the Truckee River in Northern California. Off the map, he told his friends. He threw away his business cards and made a list of things he wanted to do. One, build a shed. That's a good place to begin. Two, chop wood. Three, lose 20 pounds. Four, up with Hank's book. He called his four-step program Washington Detox. Now, 6 months later, he is almost done. He is nearly better, nearly free of Washington, D.C. Tonight, Cash Carey is out walking his dogs on a mountain, listening for the coyotes that sometimes shadow him. The wind washes through the treetops. It sounds like rushing water. Cash Carey pivots between two thick, rough trunks. His shaved head, his broad brush eyebrows, his blackest brown eyes all turn sharply. He opens his hands into the darkness. This makes $700 billion seem small. Now, the thing that I find most striking here is the fact that this guy literally went from the pinnacle of political and economic power to living as a wilderness hermit. And I find that to be not only a case of detoxifying from the foul humors of the imperial capital, but it's a reassertion of very sound priorities. He had the means to do it. He had means to build his own little self-sustaining environment in the company of his wife. They became an independent polis. In a word, he seceded. Now, if he had been willing to secede entirely, withdraw himself entirely from the ambit of Washington's supposed authority, he wouldn't have been collaborating in Hank Paulson's self-exculpatory memoir, and he certainly wouldn't have himself tethered by way of his BlackBerry to people who were still either members of or servitors of the power elite. But I find it really interesting and more than a little bit ironic that this guy, who was in charge of rescuing the banks, actually doling out the cash to bail out the banks as soon as he possibly could, got out of Washington and started living like the much derided off-the-grid guns and groceries crowd, who in many instances are living the same way he lived because of the types of things that he and his colleagues did. It's really interesting. Just over the last couple of days, the fair gem state has once again been defiled by people crossing into Yellowstone Park. Actually, not to Yellowstone Park. Forgive me. They've been going to Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Many of them have made the transit across Idaho to gather at the Rockefeller readout there for a review of the economy. The Federal Reserve, the people who are the creme de la scum of our system, assembles in Jackson Hole, Wyoming every year, this time of year, in order to devise some kind of a cover story to justify their continued maladministration of a system that no human being can employ rationally. You know, Commissar Bernanke was there saying that the Federal Reserve would intervene only in the event that the recovery doesn't gather momentum, doesn't find its footing. There is no recovery. This is not a recovery. Even Paul Krugman might be one of the few people on Earth who would be competitive in terms of pure, incurable stupidity with Sean Hannity. Paul Krugman would be one of that, I don't think elite is the right word, one of that narrowly defined few. even Paul Krugman admitted recently, within the last couple of days, that this is not a recovery, that we have not yet hit bottom. This is a guy who has been a loyal scribe for the Federal Reserve and the Keynesian priesthood for his entire life. Robert Reich, whose politics are just as unsound as Krugman, but whose intellect and honesty are superior, says we're not going to see a double dip. This is not a double dip. This is one big splat that we're experiencing. Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network, 866-986-6397 is our call-in number. We'll be back in just a minute. On the subject of liberation theology again, that's what happens. I get sort of scattershot in my choice of topic here. Earlier in the program, I believe in the first hour and part of the second hour, we were talking about the event today, the Restoring Honor rally in Washington, D.C., and how Mr. Beck, Glenn Beck, the organizer of that event, who describes himself appropriately enough as a rodeo clown, I've often thought that he's a better specimen of something else you'd find at a rodeo in terms of retreating equine anatomy. I think he's more of a stalking horse or a cat's paw or a Judas goat. There are a number of zoological metaphors I could apply here. But Mr. Beck, over the last couple of weeks, has been talking intermittently about liberation theology, and he describes the left-wing version of liberation theology very well, but he espouses and promotes a, for lack of a better way of describing it, right-wing version of liberation theology, in which the apparatus of enforcement and coercion that we call the military is sacralized and treated as if it somehow is a form of applied Christian charity, I suppose, to be involved in promoting what we're forced to call, almost, liberation at the point of a gun, at the point of a bayonet, point of a tomahawk. And I've made mention of this very useful book called The War for Righteousness by Richard M. Gamble. Let me read the entire title here. The War for Righteousness, Progressive Christianity, the Great War, and the Rise of the Messianic Nation. Now, what was the theme of Mr. Beck's Lincoln Center affair last night, where he introduced what he called the New Black Regiment? It's about America's divine destiny. That's messianic language. Now, as somebody who is a believer in the Christian gospel, I do believe that God has a destiny for nations as well as individuals. I do believe that God is sovereign over all elements of life. At the end of the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus says that all authority, all power is given to him on heaven and in earth. That means that his law is sovereign in every realm of life, whether we choose to acknowledge it or not. It's there as a Christian believer. That is one of the foundations of my worldview. So I don't dispute the idea that the divinity, the providential being who spoke the universe into existence, has a destiny for the United States of America. But I don't believe that Mr. Beck is a tuning fork that vibrates with the otherwise unheard spiritual messages that define that divine destiny. And I don't happen to believe that the government of the United States is a divine instrument in any way, shape, or form. Nor do I believe that it can be sufficiently purged and purified as would be required to make it suitable as an instrument of divine purpose. And I consider it to be a form of blasphemy and political heresy, if you will, to ascribe in any way a type of divinity to the government of the United States. These are nostrums of the progressive, secularized, collectivized Christianity of the 19th and early 20th centuries that gave us Woodrow Wilson and Edward Mandel House. More importantly, even than Woodrow Wilson, is Edward Mandel House. Woodrow, Edward Mandel House was the modern creator of liberation theology, this admixture of Marxism and Christianity. If you read Philip Drew Administrator, and I had the privilege about 12 years ago of writing a foreword to the most recent republication, the most recent reissue of that book, Philip Drew Administrator has a foreword that I wrote to it, and I focused on the fact that Edward Mandel House talked about the idea of the ideal government being socialism as dreamed of by Karl Marx with a spiritual leavening. That's liberation theology. That's also progressivism of the American variety that led to support for America's involvement in World War I. By way of illustrating how this worked in practice, I'm going to read the following. Clarence Waldron was in his element addressing large emotional crowds. In spite of that fact, the throng that gathered in front of the First Baptist Church in Windsor, Vermont, wasn't interested in hearing a sermon. They wanted Waldron to repent for refusing to recognize October 21st, 1917, as Liberty Loan Sunday. President Woodrow Wilson, acting as pontiff of the American civil religion, quote, expected the nation's clergy to decorate their churches in red, white, and blue, and to lead their congregation in singing the Star-Spangled Banner, recounts Vermont historian Mark Bushnell. The idea was to encourage congregants to buy liberty bonds to fund the war. Across the country, Across the country, clergy members complied. So too in Windsor, Vermont, except at Waldron's church, where that Sunday's service was no different than any other. Waldron, comments Bushnell, was more a pillar of the community than an enemy of the state. But as a theologically conservative Protestant, Waldron could not bring himself to take up a collection on behalf of what he regarded as war carried out on behalf of an increasingly lawless state. To placate the mob, Waldron wrapped himself in the American flag and sang the Star-Spangled Banner, continues Bushnell. But this was only the beginning of his sorrows. In short order, Waldron was removed as pastor, in part because his Pentecostal preaching style was at odds with the Baptist Church's accustomed mode of worship, but also because of lingering suspicions about his loyalty. The following December, a federal grand jury, think about that for a second, indicted Waldron for violating the Espionage Act. Passed the previous June, that act dictated prison terms of up to 20 years for any act or statement perceived as willfully obstructing, quote, the recruiting or enlistment service of the United States. The specific charge against Waldron, an admitted Christian pacifist, he was a conservative, remember, theologically, was that, quote, he had once been heard to say, to hell with patriotism. This was true, he admitted under oath, but the comment had been made about the cultish nationalism promoted by Kaiser Wilhelm's regime in Germany. If this is patriotism, Waldron had told his acquaintances, to hell with patriotism. Waldron was eventually convicted and sentenced to 15 years in prison, of which he served little more than a year. He was one of nearly 1,000 Americans sent to prison under the Espionage Act or the subsequent Sedition Act, and the first to be put on trial solely for his religious beliefs. Waldron's crime was blasphemy against the Almighty State. Here was somebody who was theologically conservative and who was politically conservative, and he was patriotic, meaning he was attached to the proposition. He can't be attached to a proposition. He subscribed to the proposition that the United States of America, as a country, as a culture, was worthy of his love and support, and that the government defined by the Constitution was worthy of his support as a citizen, inasmuch as it was devoted to the rule of law. He ended up being sent to prison for a year because he had criticized the type of maniacal, febrile nationalism that had been displayed in Germany, where, of course, you will recall, those who were conscripted into the army were sent out wearing belt buckles, carrying the design, God mit uns, God is with us. If this is patriotism, Clarence Waldron said, to hell with patriotism. by way of criticizing what was going on in Wilhelmine, Germany. But the problem is, he didn't understand that that same malady was at epidemic proportions in the United States of America. And because he wanted to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ, as opposed to promoting the idea of the messianic nation state, he ended up spending a year in prison. That was how liberation theology played out during World War One. And you know what? There's more than merely a hint or a savor of that same type of blinkered, reflexive, jingoistic, nationalistic bigotry in what Mr. Beck is promoting. When he describes the military as the distilled essence of all that is noble and good, while abominating the incumbent administration, while saying that somehow collective action focused on and working through Washington can restore the honor of an innately dishonorable government, make it worthy of the military that is its chief enforcement tool. He's promoting the same type of degenerate nationalism that was on display in Germany. And that was what got this Clarence Waldron in trouble, was condemning that type of degenerate nationalism while extolling traditional American patriotism. They're not the same thing. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. 866-986-6397 is our call number. We'll be back in just a minute or two.
System memory crash.
Now, back to our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Grigg.
It may be surprising to some that the much discussed and much maligned Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf is promoting liberation theology of a sort that's very similar to what Glenn Beck is promoting. Now, over the last couple of weeks, Mr. Beck has joined in the chorus, the shrill and ululating chorus of outrage over the things that Imam Rauf has said that are considered to be seditious at worst or injudicious at very best. For instance, when Imam Rauf says that the government of the United States has more blood on its hands of Muslims than Al-Qaeda has of innocent non-Muslims, Mr. Rauf is telling the truth. It's factually incontestable that the government of the United States has killed more Muslims than Al-Qaeda has killed Muslims or anybody else. The aggregate body count of Al-Qaeda is nowhere near as large as that of the United States. If you were to amortize the mortality rate, the morbidity rate rather, early morbidity rate, of the victims of the U.S.-led embargo of Iraq between 1991 and 2003, as well as the two wars that were fought from 1991 and then the war from 2003 to the present in Iraq, if you were to amortize those deaths, you'd find that Iraq, on average, has suffered the equivalent of a 9/11 every single day since 1991. That puts things in perspective, or at least it should, unless you're somebody whose synapses are rendered functionally useless because they're clotted with jingoistic, nationalistic prejudices, or unless you're being paid to inflict that damage on others the way that the likes of Sean Hannity are employed. So when Faisal Abdul Rauf says such things, he's considered to be on the pay because he's not a regimist. He's not being criticized because of his religious views. He's being criticized because he doesn't properly venerate the United States. I refer to it as the United States, specifically and intentionally. Todd Gitlin, who's sort of a left-leaning sociologist and historian, writes the following about Mr. Rauf, or Imam Rauf. This is from the August 24th New Republic. The fervent mosque haters have this much right. Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf, the Sufi leader of the Cordoba Initiative, The plans to build an Islamic center on Park Place near the site of the World Trade Center is subversive. But what he wants to subvert is not the United States of America. What he wants to subvert are dictatorships in Islamic nations. Imam Rao's third book, excuse me, published in 2005 but unavailable to me last week when I wrote about him, and his earlier work is called What's Right with Islam is What's Right with America. In these pages, Rao proves just as Islamic as his detractors say. He is downright idealistic about Islam and hearty about its prospects. He has been scouting out America for a long time, and what is it that he finds here to gladden his Islamic soul? It's right there on page 176. Quote, the Declaration of Independence and Constitution. The Imam goes on to say that these documents, quote, express the Islamic ideal, which is itself but an expression of the Abrahamic ethic. Yes, quote, the American Constitution and system of governance uphold the core principles of Islamic law. And here's a way of putting it that never tempted Sarah Palin or Newt Gingrich. Quote, the overarching American religion that all Americans live under is, quote, Islamic in the sense that it is fully compliant with and expresses the Islamic Sharia. In Rao's understanding, Sharia is predicated on religious pluralism, which is, quote, a fundamental human right under Islamic law. Let me interject something here. Sharia can mean many things. What it means, in essence, is the path. As I understand it, that is the most direct translation of the term into English. And the path can be defined by people who are either authoritarian or latitudinarian. But Sharia law simply means that you as a Muslim, assuming that you are a Muslim, which I am not, and many of you most likely are not either, would try to apply the tenets of your religious faith to every aspect of your lives. As a Christian, that's what I attempt to do, however inadequately. My Jewish friends do the same thing with respect to the halakhic teachings that they have learned, particularly those of my Jewish friends who are Orthodox, and that would be pretty much all of them. I don't know if I have any Reformed Jewish friends. All of my Jewish friends tend to be very Jewish, and that I find to be quite commendable. But they try to apply Torah principles to every aspect of their lives. That doesn't mean that necessarily they're trying to make the rest of us live as Jews. What they say is that if you live according to the two great commandments and you accept the Shema from Deuteronomy, if you believe in one God and you believe that the first and highest commandment is to love him with all your heart and the second commandment is to love your neighbor as yourself, that you're living a lifestyle that is compatible with Judaism. That's Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf's perspective with respect to the Constitution. To put it another way, one of my friends, who's Jewish, and very, very Jewish at that, spent some time in prison because of pranks that he pulled by way of protesting the institutionalized anti-Semitism of the Soviet regime. He was one of these people who agitated on behalf of the refuseniks, hundreds of thousands of Soviet Jews who wanted to emigrate to Israel or elsewhere where they could actually live as Jews. He went to prison because he did some things that the federal government deemed to be acts of terrorism. They weren't acts of terrorism, they were pranks. Things like throwing marbles on the ice rink at Rockefeller Plaza, just as the Soviet ice capades performers were about to go on as part of a cultural exchange program. That's what got him sent to prison. But while he was there, he wanted to receive kosher food. It's not an unreasonable request. He had a special diet. As a believing Jew, he was going to eat kosher food or he was going to go hungry. And he explained to me that this was not an extraordinary demand because a kosher meal could be a peanut butter sandwich. That would be perfectly kosher. Now, a meal that would meet with the religious approval of a Muslim would be very similar. You wouldn't be imposing Sharia law on a prison if, as a Muslim inmate, you demanded to receive food that was not halal. I believe that's the proper way of expressing that thought. I hope so, anyway. It's late. But in order to get a kosher meal, you ask for a peanut butter sandwich. As a Muslim, you could satisfy your own religious requirements the same way. What Faisal Abdul Rauf is saying here is that as it stands right now under the Constitution and Declaration of Independence, the order of politics in this country is Sharia compliant. We don't need to be ruled by mullahs. We don't need to be ruled by public squads dedicated to the enforcement of virtue and suppression of vice like they have in Saudi Arabia. From his perspective, living as we are, a nation of Christians, Muslims, Jews, Hindus, non-believers, etc., governed by laws that resonate with Abrahamic principles, that's already Sharia compliant. We don't need to be forcing the non-Muslims to live as dhimmis from that point of view. That's the point he's making. To that extent, he's saying things that are perhaps worthwhile and perhaps commendable, although I don't like the fact that he's very syncretistic in his outlook. By the way, for those of you who are familiar with the TV show Serenity and the TV show Firefly and the wonderful movie Serenity that was begotten by the TV show, think about this for a second. Doesn't Imam Rauf look a lot like Book, the shepherd? Or Shepherd? Was his name Book or was his name Shepherd? The preacher! The preacher who's played by the same actor who was in Barney Miller. I think he looks quite a bit like him. Now, the book by Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf, Islam, What's Right with Islam is Right with America, according to Todd Gitlin, the reviewer here, ends with an appendix containing a fatwa issued by five Muslim clerics on September 27, 2001, at the request of the most senior Muslim chaplain in the American Armed Forces. Ending his book with a fatwa, yes, cunningly. It's a, quote, fatwa permitting U.S. Muslim military personnel to participate in Afghanistan, to participate in the Afghanistan war effort. Now think about that for a second. It ends with a fatwa permitting an aggressive war against Afghanistan. That's why I've got problems with Faisal Abdul Rauf. Not because he's promoting jihad, but rather because he's too close to the government in Washington. What's Right with Islam, by the way, concludes Gitlin, was published by Harper San Francisco, which last I looked is owned by Rupert Murdoch. He's the same guy who owns Fox News and the Wall Street Journal and all these other media outlets of the war party who have been execrating Imam Abdul Faisal Rauf as a jihadist. There's something about this that really doesn't smell quite right. And maybe next week I'll have more to say on that subject. In the meantime, thank you for joining me this evening, especially those of you who called in. I want to offer a special thanks to those of you, and I know you're out there, who donated to my family this past week by way of PayPal. God bless you. You're actually making it possible for us to meet our expenses in the coming month, and I will forever be grateful to you. Please join me online at Pro Libertate, the blog, freedominourtime.blogspot.com. I'll be back with you next week. Have a wonderful Lord's Day tomorrow, and as always, Dum Spirito Pugno. While I breathe, I fight. Good night, good luck, and God bless.